It is a pleasure to be here this morning, but when I was first invited to preach, I wondered why. Why me? Well, I did some reflection. I figured, well, today is Mother's Day, and both Pastor Chris and Pastor Siobhan have their children and would want to spend time with them, so they needed someone else to preach. And in asking me, they sort of adhered to the old adage among pastors of never invite a better pastor into your pulpit. They need not worry. Well, today is Mother's Day. And contrary to the belief of some, this is not a holiday that was started by Hallmark cards. It had its origins well before Hallmark was founded in 1868. After the Civil War, in West Virginia, Ann Jarvis tried to establish Mother's Day as a holiday to celebrate the mothers who had sons who had fought and died on both sides of the Civil War. She sought to reunite the families that had been divided by the war. Now, the holiday caught on in West Virginia and a few other states, but it soon sputtered out. In 1905, Anne's daughter, Anna Jarvis, with the support of a Philadelphia merchant, John Wanamaker, revived her mother's efforts to establish Mother's Day as a holiday. And in 1908, their efforts met some success when various states adopted Mother's Day as a holiday. It was celebrated then, as now, on the anniversary of Anne's death, the second Sunday in May. And it became a national holiday in 1914 when Woodrow Wilson signed the proclamation establishing it to honor all mothers. Hallmark cards only dates back to 1910, well after Mother's Day was fully in the air. But once established, the holiday became extremely popular. With popularity came commercialization. And this commercialization with the cards and the candies and the gifts and the flowers and everything else became too much for Anna. She regretted that she had ever, ever started the holiday. And so great was her resentment that she actually petitioned Congress to repeal the holiday. I have not seen any reaction by the merchant John Wanamaker to Anna's change of heart. One might suppose it was not favorable. But today is Mother's Day. And is customary the common lectionary used by many churches seems to be out of sync with the civil holidays. How does the reading we just heard from John square with Mother's Day? I thought long and hard about it. At least 5 minutes. How do you preach this? For at first blush, the gospel lesson and the holiday seem inconsistent with one another. Let me explain. There's an old stereotype about love. There are two types of love, the mother's love and the father's love. The mother's love is supposed to be unconditional. Whereas a father's love is not. It is often quite conditional. If you get straight A's, both your mother and your father will love you. That is not the case if you get an F. Your mother will continue to love you, but your father's love, not so much. A mother's love persists no matter what. A father gives love for performance. As a child, I quickly learned that when I got into trouble, see mom first. She would love me no matter what. Whereas dad, I suspect many of us grew up with these perceptions. But like every stereotype, the unconditional nature of motherly love as opposed to the conditional nature of fatherly love is true only to a certain extent and only at certain times. Nevertheless, it's an overgeneralization that can help us clarify thinking. But mother's love will have its limits. My daughter learned that. If you did not already know it, when she learned it when she was 11. She became concerned about the fate of the ozone layer and the harm then being posed by chlorofluorocarbons. I got that out, too. Mm-hmm. Which were then being used as propellants in aerosols. My daughter decided to go green. And so she tossed all the sprays in the house into the trash. Well, her mother was a little upset by this. Her mother became really upset when she discovered that my daughter had tossed her new bottle of Paco Rabanne perfume. Even unconditional love has its conditions. But we are taught that God's love is unconditional, like the stereotypical mother's love. As reported by John, God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whoever believed in him should not perish, but have everlasting life. Now, Jesus stresses elsewhere the universality and unconditionality of the salvation that comes through his crucifixion and resurrection. In one spot, for example, he says, "And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself." God's love is not conditioned upon us doing certain things or not doing certain things. God, we are taught, loves us no matter what. But there's a clinker. Today's passage from John, which is found in what is sometimes called the last discourse of Jesus, his valedictory speech to his disciples the night before his arrest and crucifixion. In this extended discourse, which begins in chapter 13 of the Gospel and goes through chapter 11, one of the longest chunks of the Gospel, Jesus gives his final instructions to his disciples. In the list of who is there is no mention of a stenographer. So scholars have questioned whether this is indeed an accurate transcript of what Jesus said, or whether this is more likely a literary construction modeled on the farewell speeches that were very much a part of Greek literature of the day. This is a tradition that includes Plato's Apology, a recreation of Socrates' farewell to his disciples before his execution. None of the other canonical Gospels have a parallel discourse. None even reflect it. We would expect that if this had been the case, it would have been. We would have some clues. After all, Jesus' last days seem to be a major concern, or our major focus, of each of the Gospels. Now, John's Gospel is thought to be the last written of the canonical Gospels, and probably written between 90 and 125, probably some nearly 60 years after Jesus' death at the earliest. By that time, Jesus' followers had already seen a split with the Jews, and they'd already faced several persecutions with more to come. Did the current circumstances perhaps color John's account? Because one theme that shines forth very clearly in today's passage is the conditional nature of God's love. Jesus says, If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love. Jesus doesn't say what happens if we don't keep the commandments. But one thing is probably sure, we're better off if we do than if we don't. Later in the text, Jesus says, "You are my friends if you do what I command you." Does that mean we are not Jesus' friends if we don't do what Jesus commands? Does that sound like a friendship to you? Sounds to me more like a master-servant relationship. There's no idea of a two-way street, no notion of reciprocity that so often marks true friendships. There is no notion of forgiveness. Here, John portrays Jesus as a taskmaster, perhaps a harsh one at that. In this text, we also deal with the notion of commanding friends to do things. Commanding and being a friend don't seem consistent with one another. friends don't usually command each other. I mean, would you want to be friends with somebody who gives you commands all the time? I mean, is that somebody you'd want to kick back, watch the game, and have a beer with? Something else must be going on in the text, but what? Again, Jesus tells his disciples, I appointed you to go and bear fruit, fruit that will last so that the Father will give you whatever you ask of him in my name. In other words, if we bear fruit, God will give us what we want. If we don't bear fruit, or don't bear enough fruit, will God turn God's back on us? Jesus is quiet about this. And this seems very much out of sync with the rest of the gospel message. While John's gospel rarely uses the words command or commandment, nearly half of the uses of those words occur in just this one little brief passage. Too much to be ignored. Perhaps the key to this lies in what is being commanded. What is it that Jesus commands of his disciples? And by extension, what is it he commands of us? He says, "This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you." And he continues with an example of what that love entails. He continues, "No one has greater love than this, to lay down one's life for one's friends." Clearly, Jesus is foreshadowing his own arrest and execution, and in doing so, bodying forth his love for his disciples. By extension, this is his love for the whole of humankind, and this is more than just a foreshadowing, for it is what Jesus asks of us. He also commands us to be prepared to lay down our lives for one another. Now, this may be a reference to the situation in the church at the time of the writing of John's gospel. The church had already seen several major persecutions. A number of Jesus' early followers had fallen away. Some had died. The expected second coming had not occurred. In fact, the world had not ended. And simply put, being a Christian was a fairly dangerous thing to be. The early persecutions under the Romans, while were rare, there were only two major persecutions in the early days, one under the Emperor Nero in 64, who accused Christians of being behind the burning of Rome, and the other under the Emperor Domitian during the 90s. But while the Roman persecutions were rare, there were many persecutions at the hand of local communities. We are told, for example, of the martyrdom of Stephen. This was at the hands of the members of the synagogue in Jerusalem. Paul, who was a member of that synagogue before his conversion, had a hand in Stephen's being stoned to death. But Paul, in turn, would be martyred, as would Peter and a host of the other early followers of Jesus. Clearly, the writer of John's gospel anticipated further persecutions. While those who held the church, those who did not forswear their faith, those who held the course in the face of death, were celebrated by the early church. But not all church members wanted to become martyrs. They didn't particularly relish the idea of laying down their lives for their friends. Things were too good. But is martyrdom what Jesus is demanding of us as a condition for his friendship? It seems what the focus of Jesus' command is that we love one another. And the love that Jesus seeks is a self-sacrificial love, a love that puts the needs of others ahead of one's own needs. So we're still stuck with the original question. How does today's text relate to Mother's Day? And here we come back to that old stereotype of motherly love, the love that is self-sacrificing. the early church came up with an image for this. It was the image of the mother pelican. Legend has it that in times of famine, the pelican would pierce her breast and bring forth blood to feed her young. Early on, by the second century, this image was associated with Jesus. In part, it was a Eucharistic symbol, a symbol of the body and blood of Christ in the Lord's Supper. But it was also a symbol of the self-sacrificial love. Let me suggest that we take seriously the notion of self-sacrificial love for one another, for this is the love that Jesus asks us. We find our model for such love in the self-sacrifice of our mothers. Like the pelican, they went through much to keep us going. My mother never failed to remind me of that. Nevertheless, to her dying day, I knew that she had my back. I was certain of her unconditional love, no matter what. So let us take time these days to give thanks, or this day, for the gifts that our mothers have given us. But let us also commit ourselves to love one another as Jesus loved us. As we love one another, let us strive to emulate the pelican, that self-sacrificial love that feeds its young with its own blood. Let us strive to emulate the sacrificial love embodied in the love of motherhood. Let us follow Jesus' command to love one another as he loved us. Amen.
Amen.